WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. And this is one of the parents of one of the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
I enter this? Uh-huh. Hello. My name is Muriel Cleese, and I live in a very nice elderly people's home in Weston-super-Mare. My son John is in the new Monty Python film, Life of Brian. Do hope you'll go and see it, because he's on a percentage, and he says if it doesn't do well, he won't be able to keep me on in the home any longer. So see The Life of Brian now, because I'm 102 years old, and if I have to leave here, it'll kill me.
In 1979, when Monty Python's Life of Brian was released, Cleese and company had a lot more to worry about than whether John's mom would stay comfortable. Decades before The Passion of the Christ, this British comedy troupe came up with the idea of telling a comic story about someone who lived during the lifetime of Jesus Christ. Life of Brian also ended with a crucifixion, only this time the people on the cross were singing. Blasphemy? That's how many people felt at the time. Think about how much controversy Mel Gibson's movie stirred today. Then go back in time a few decades and substitute comedy for drama. Here are Michael Palin and Eric Idle in a typically irreverent scene.
Next. Crucifixion.
Yes.
Good. Out of the door, line on the left, one cross each. Next. Crucifixion.
Yes.
Good. Out of the door, line on the left, one cross each. Next. Crucifixion?
No, freedom.
What?
Freedom for me. They said I hadn't done anything so I could go free and live on an island somewhere.
Oh. Oh, well, that's jolly good. Well, off you go then.
Nah, man, you're pulling your leg. It's crucifixion, really.
Oh, I see. Very good, very good. Well, out of the door.
Yeah, another way. Out the door, one cross each, line on the left.
Line on the left, yes. Thank you. Crucifixion?
Yes.
Good.
The original studio backing the film, England's EMI Studios, withdrew its funding just as shooting was about to commence. It was only when George Harrison came to the rescue and provided the money to complete and distribute the film that Monty Python's Life of Brian was saved. Harrison said then that Monty Python was the comic reincarnation of the Beatles. And given how much trouble John Lennon got into when talking about how the Beatles were bigger than Christ, it was an apt comparison. Life of Brian continued getting in trouble, too. It wasn't even released in England until after it premiered in America. Religious leaders in both countries attacked it. But once the film was seen and embraced by audiences, who enjoyed its silliness as well as its subtext, Life of Brian was hailed as a success. On its 25th anniversary, Life of Brian is being re-released in a big way. Not just on DVD, where it's available already, but in movie theaters, where it opened recently. In the context of The Passion of the Christ, it has a new currency. But the movie doesn't need that association or that excuse to be resurrected and enjoyed. Today on Fresh Air, we visit with four of the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus: John Cleese, Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and our first guest, Graham Chapman. Chapman, who died in 1989, spoke to Terry 2 years earlier. In Life of Brian, Chapman has the title role as Brian Cohen, the film's reluctant would-be messiah. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Chapman was a trained physician and a gay rights activist. Before the interview, let's hear him in a classic Python sketch.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings!
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit! Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert!
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
Oh, Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains.
Ah, yes. You want room 12A, just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Graham Chapman dishing out the abuse. Terry asked him if his early sketches with Monty Python were considered too risque or eccentric.
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping. They generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good, because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. Naughty words, really. Just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable, I suppose, because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
I think that there's a lot of British humour and Monty Python-type humour that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different?
Yes, I suppose there are. Although we were quite fortunate in that respect, in that during the whole TV series, we tended not, on the whole, to use topical humour. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that will be pretty meaningless now.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
John and I wrote together, Michael Payne and Terry Jones wrote together, Eric wrote on his own, and then Terry Gilliam did all the animations and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe. Anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then, about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything, and at that point we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation open up Roger's Thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of your sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
almost directly from Roger's Thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caithness?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Japanese Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Of course, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Wensleydale?
Yes.
Ah, well, I'll have some of that.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me, sir. Mr. Wensleydale, that's my name.
Greek feta?
Not as such.
Gorgonzola?
No.
Parmesan?
No.
Mozzarella? Pepper crema? No. Danish...
When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them,
or dump them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humor like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you don't. Fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his. And they seemed to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Graham Chapman, speaking with Terry Gross in 1987, 2 years before his death. He has the title role in Monty Python's Life of Brian, re-released now in theaters and on DVD. Of all the Monty Python players, John Cleese arguably is the most famous. He has the most successful non-Python comedy film in A Fish Called Wanda. He's part of the James Bond franchise now, playing Q, the exasperated weapons specialist who gives new gadgets to the new 007. And on TV, he starred in and co-wrote one of the classic comedies of all time, Fawlty Towers. When Terry spoke to Cleese in 1990, it wasn't comedy that had brought him to town. It was a family therapy conference where he led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner.
Now, so much of your humor has to do with, kind of skewering a certain businessman mentality or civil service mentality. Now, your father was an insurance salesman,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder if you got some of what those people were like from watching your father and his
Oh, yes, I'm sure that's right. And I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie finally sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work, comedians, often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off, and they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Well, wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Carlton and Tempertonis. Yeah, well, they glupose and overcollot the Murgatruses. They're stavilogus across the bottom, part of Isaac Cruz together in mid-slever the underpedity, and fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slope of action. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is. When I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yes, you take the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958, and I've never forgotten it. It got me into the Footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tick, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I used my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life
mm-hmm.
or into a parody of that.
When I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. So, and if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself's quite a cheerful prospect.
He's grinning.
Now, your mother was an acrobat? Is it? This happens to me all the time.
I get fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No, so, you know, I always, like, very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually, like, one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then, of course, it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten it. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was stage-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
John Cleese, speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Monty Python's Life of Brian is back in theaters 25 years after it was first shown. We'll continue our tribute to the Pythons after this break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Palin was a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus and co-starred in the Python films including Monty Python and the Holy Grail, The Meaning of Life, and The Life of Brian, which is now back in theaters 25 years after it was first released. Palin also appeared with fellow Python John Cleese in the films A Fish Called Wanda and Fierce Creatures. More recently, he's done some very intelligent and funny travel series for television. Terry Gross spoke to him in 1990 and asked him about his upbringing.
Well, I was a nice middle-class boy, I suppose. My mother didn't work. My father was an engineer by trade and was born and brought up in the south of England. He was a doctor's son. And he became an export manager of a big steelworks in Sheffield. I don't think he really particularly wanted to do that. I mean, I think he'd actually been much happier to be a church organist, but one was sort of pushed into the professions then. And so we lived on really very low salary in quite a nice house in Sheffield.
You grew up after the war. How did the post-war days affect your sensibility, do you think, and, you know, your worldview when you were young?
Well, the days of austerity and scarcity here, and I can remember countries like America and Australia especially were like the land of plenty where all the opportunities were. It meant, in a strange way, that you sort of guarded what you had rather carefully. I mean, my father was a real notebook man and kept brown paper bags for several years, you know, and used to iron bits of string. It was that sort of thing, and had lots and lots of little tins with sort of, you know, left-handed cufflinks and things in one tin, and bits of, you know, sort of old Brazil nut shells in another. We kept absolutely everything, and I quite like that. I'm still rather I love detail myself, both in sort of life and work. I tend to notice bits of detail, and in a sense it's made me sort of, or perhaps helped to make me feel very sort of fond of life, and rather sort of glad that I've got what I have now, and that we are brought up in a time of comparative plenty.
The Pythons always had a lot of drag humor. I was wondering if you were ever taken to drag shows or, you know, to female impersonation shows when you were younger.
No, not really. I went to pantomime, which is a peculiarly English phenomenon, I think, isn't it? You don't have pantomime in America.
Well, explain what it is.
Well, it's a Christmas show based on a reworking of a fairy story like Jack and the Beanstalk or Babes in the Wood, in which the women play the men and the men play the women.
I don't think we have that.
Well, they have a principal boy, which is always played by a woman in a big pair of black tights and sort of little costume. She slaps her thigh a lot, and, you know, the woman would play Dick Whittington, for instance, and say, "Come on, puss," and all that in a sort of very butch voice. And the men would play the ugly sisters in Cinderella. So that was my first, I suppose, that, you know, every Christmas I would see men in getting laughs out of being in drag, playing things like the ugly sisters or Dick Whittington's mother or things like that. And they were always fairly incompetent. I don't know if that's a sign of, you know, how men saw themselves or how men saw women, but there you are.
How often did you dress in drag for the Python shows?
it sounds like sort of drag addicts confessions, doesn't it? Not really that often. Uh-huh. I should think probably once every other show we got into women's outfits. Mm. Strange, isn't it, really? But I must say, we did quite enjoy it. Because Python was sort of rather like, I mean, people say, why didn't you get women to play the women in Python? But that wasn't really the point. Python itself was sort of a really self-contained show where the six writers did everything. And the sort of many of the characters were rather sort of caricatures, or fairly outrageous, of a sort of cartoon feel to them. And so we were playing types of men rather than the man himself. And we were playing types of women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't really, I never convinced myself as a woman, whereas someone like Eric or Graham could look really rather wonderful. And Terry Jones, I mean, used to play his mother regularly and was wonderful. You know, one could almost think, I wish Terry would stay like that. He'd make such someone a wonderful mum.
Michael Palin, formerly of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Their film, Monty Python's Life of Brian, is back in theaters after 25 years. We have one more Python coming up in the second part of our show. Eric Idle, with his guitar. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The 1979 movie Monty Python's Life of Brian, a comedy that takes place during the lifetime of Jesus Christ, has been re-released on DVD and in theaters. On today's archive edition, we're hearing from several of the members of the British comedy troupe. Eric Idle wrote many of the comic songs used in Python sketches and movies. He also was a prominent figure in The Ruddles, playing the Paul McCartney role in that brilliant parody of the Beatles. And here he is in a scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, their parody of the King Arthur legend. Idle is looking for the Grail and has found a clue carved in a cave.
There! Look!
What does it say?
What language is that? Brother Maynard!
You're our scholar.
It's Aramaic. Of course, Joseph of Arimathea.
Of course. What does it say?
It reads, here may be found the last words of Joseph of Arimathea. He who is valiant and pure of spirit may find the Holy Grail in the castle of...
What?
The castle of...
What is that?
He must have died while carving it.
Oh, come on.
Well, that's what it says.
Look, if he was dying, he wouldn't bother to carve Argh. He'd just say it.
Well, that's what's carved in the rock.
Perhaps he was dictating.
Oh, shut up.
Well, does it say anything else?
No. Just Argh.
That was Eric Idle translating the Aramaic. When Terry spoke with him in 1999, he performed some of the songs he wrote during his years with the Pythons. He had just published his comic science fiction novel, The Road to Mars, set in the 24th century. The main character is an android named Carlton. He's writing a thesis on the nature of 20th century comedy, investigating whether there is a comedy gene. As part of his research, he's watching tapes of old TV shows. Here's a reading.
He thinks he almost finds some evidence with one of the guys on a very weird show called Monty Python's Flying Circus. I've seen the tapes, and boy, does it suck. It's strange rather than funny. Five limeys and a yank. No girls, they did drag. Typical Brits. They're never happier than when dressing up as women. What is it with them? It's a stupid show, as I say, and Carlton found it totally puzzling. Heads come off or pop open in demented animations. Sheep drop on people's heads for no reason whatsoever. Vikings sing love songs to pressed meat. Weird men dressed as old ladies squeak in silly voices. There are dead parrots and Spanish Inquisitions. It's all very silly nonsense. They seem dangerously cuckoo to me. Carlton couldn't make head or tail of it. But it seemed from the tape that the audience laughed. As far as he could tell, it was genuine, not canned laughter. In casually cross-checking the genetic backgrounds of the six strange men involved, he turned up an ancestor for one of them in showbiz. Eric Idle's great-grandfather, Henry Bertrand, a Victorian gentleman from the 1890s, had been a circus manager. Was this the genetic missing link? His great-grandfather was a ringmaster in a circus, and Idle was in a flying circus? Surely this was significant. Of course it wasn't. Turned out Idle was screwed up by losing his RAF rear gunner father in a traffic accident in World War II. Irony, eh? Killed coming home from on Christmas leave after surviving the war. This was compounded by being stuck in a semi-orphanage for 12 years with a bunch of fatherless boys. The circus thing was just a coincidence, but you can see the lengths he went to in searching for the comedy gene.
Well, thanks for reading that excerpt of your book, The Road to Mars. And before I get to some of the things about your biography that are referred to in that passage, I want to ask you a little bit about the comedy of Monty Python. I mean, it looks ridiculous to Carlton centuries after the fact. He doesn't understand at all the surrealism and visual and verbal non-sequiturs that the Python's comedy was based on. And I'm wondering why you think that so much of the Python comedy was based on surrealism and non-sequiturs.
Well, first of all, Carlton doesn't get it because he's an android. He doesn't get much.
Good point. Thank you.
He has no sense of irony whatsoever. And if you tell him to say, people say, like, get out of here, he leaves the room. And that's part of his problem, really. He can't understand the secondary levels of meaning in language, which is where comedy lurks. And also, it's kind of fun to sort of abuse Python from the future. It's kind of a nice, comfortable position to look back at our own work.
But getting back to the question of why so much of the Python humor was about surrealism and visual and verbal non sequiturs.
I think that we thought it was reality. I think that that's the way we look at things. I mean, it isn't really non sequiturs. The world doesn't make much sense, and we always try and pretend it does. And comedy's job is to point out that it doesn't make any sense and it doesn't matter that much. And perhaps we reflected that a bit.
I thought we could take a break here and listen to another one of your songs. And this is a song that was done in the Monty Python movie, The Life of Brian. And the song is Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Set up for us how this song is used at the very end of The Life of Brian. And Brian is somebody whose life parallels the life of Jesus, and he ends up crucified on the cross at the end of the movie. Tell us about the song here.
Well, we had to face a complex problem of how to deal with all our characters. We're heading towards crucifixion, and we had to, there was no way of getting out of it. It was a common form of death for the Romans. It was like public hanging, you know. So we knew they were all going to have to die, and we couldn't face how could we deal with this image of the crucifixion. And we knew we were going to have a lot of people crucified because the Romans were fond of mass crucifixions. And so I said, well, let's do a song, you know, and it should be a cheery song. And so we thought the idea of people sort of singing a rather bright song as they being crucified, because they've got a couple of days, was a kind of wonderfully British sort of way of looking at things. And so I went off and I just came back and wrote this little quick little ditty, which has become an anthem in England for the many times we lose at sport.
And, of course, in the movie, your character's getting crucified as well, and you kind of kick off the song, and then all the guys getting crucified join in.
Yes. It's a rousing experience.
Would you sing it for us?
Sure. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. 'Cause life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. And always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. For life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on that bright side of life.
That's a great song, and I love the way you do it. I love the whistling, that little, and that little trombone sound that you get at the end there. That's new, isn't it?
Well, I've always been able to do that. It's kind of a boarding school thing. When you're stuck at boarding school for 12 years, one of the things you learn to do are silly and pointless things that help to pass the time. So I can do, you know, I can do horn, French horn, and various things. I've used them on records, too. It's cheaper than musicians.
I think, you know, your most famous Python sketch is the nudge, nudge, wink, wink sketch. Two men meeting for the first time in a bar. Did you write this sketch?
Yes, I did write the sketch.
Tell us about how you wrote it.
I wrote it for another show. I wrote it for Ronnie Barker, who was one of the two Ronnies. And I sent it in to some Frost show. And they sent it back unused because, of course, if you look at the script, it's incredibly boring. There are no jokes in it. It says, is your wife a goer? Know what I mean? Know what I mean? Say no more. Say no more. Nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? Say no more. Nudge, 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 nudge. It just comes straight back. And then I thought, well, that was rather funny. So I read it out at one of the really early Python meetings. Say, is your wife a goer? Eh? Know what I mean? Say no more. Say no more. Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge. Hey, wink, wink. Hey, is she a goer? Hey, does she go? Hey. And of course they fell about because it's kind of in the performance, and it's sometimes it's very hard to read comedy scripts. That's why Hollywood is so notoriously bad at reading comedy scripts, because it's often in just as the way you do it. I mean, I once picked up a Cleese sketch, a headmaster sketch, and I thought, there's nothing funny about this. And then I saw him do it, and he just reduced me to tears.
What kind of guy inspired this sketch?
The Nudge Boy is very much an English wide boy. He's, you know, he's down a pub. He's always down a pub, and he's, you know, he's a bit of a Jack the Lad. He rather fancies himself. But, of course, it's rather sad at the end. You know, he says, you know, you've slept with a lady. Yes. What's it like? So he's sort of kind of, he's that irritatingly nudgy person that really people don't behave like if they are well-behaved.
Let me play the Python sketch.
Your wife interested in photography, eh? Photographs, eh? He asked him knowingly.
Photography?
Yeah. Snap, snap, grin, grin, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more.
Oh, holiday stamps.
Could be. Could be taken on holiday. Could be. Swimming costumes. Nudge, nudge. Candid. Candid photography.
No, I'm afraid we don't have a camera.
Oh. Still. Oh! Eh? Eh? Oh!
Look, are you trying to insinuate something?
No, 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 no. Yes.
Well?
Well, I mean, you're a man of the world, aren't you? I mean, you've been around, you've been there.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, you've done it, with a lady. You've slept with a lady.
Yes.
What's it like?
So after the sketch, Eric Idle, did people come up to you for years and do the whole nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing?
That's still probably the most quoted to me, yes. And people love it so much, I just enjoy doing it. So in my stage show, I'm doing him a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Now, your father died in World War II.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances of his death? He was killed on the way home?
Well, it's just kind of ironic. You know, he was in the RAF from 1941, and he was a rear gunner in a bomber, in bombers and things, and that's a very dangerous role. And then they were coming home on leave, and they said, well, don't use the railways, they'll be crowded, it's coming towards Christmas time, you guys should hitchhike, because everybody gave the forces rides when they're in uniform. So he got a ride, and he was in the back of a lorry, a truck, and a car swerved and cut in front of them, and they went off the road, and he was crushed, and he sort of died on Christmas Eve. So it was kind of bitterly ironic, you know.
And I don't know how to say this exactly, but it kind of feeds the sense of tragic absurdity.
It certainly gives you a sense of irony. Of course, I was two and a bit, so I didn't really know why Christmases were so miserable and depressing. It really affected my mother. She never actually recovered from it. And she went into bleak depression. And part of my theory in the book is, and it's not just my theory, people I went into research a bit, is that comedians are formed by maternal abandonment and that they seek to replace some kind of parental love that they're not getting by being cute and funny and doing anything to entertain and solicit this love and this laughter from strangers.
And so that's your theory about why you became a comedian?
It probably accounts for why I did. I noticed on the playground with my daughter, who's nine, that when I go in there, I can tell which kids don't have mothers at home because they're being funny.
Eric Idle, speaking to Terry Gross in 1999. He's one of the stars of Monty Python's Life of Brian, which has just been re-released on DVD and in theaters to celebrate its 25th anniversary.